you wake in a strange room. Your clothes are foreign, and the walls are covered in objects from a different world. You don't know where or when you are, or if you're still dreaming. There are footsteps in the hall. Jumping up, you race out of the room and into the streets. You have just entered the Twilight Histories.
Welcome to the Twilight Histories, audio fiction that casts you as the hero. You are about to pass into an alternate universe. It may be strange, fascinating, and perhaps terrifying. To survive, you can't just be a tourist. You must become the people you explore. This is your adventure. Today, you're going to travel to the Yucatan Peninsula in Mexico. In its deep prehistoric past, some 12,000 years ago, near the end of the Ice Age. In this world, an ancient civilization unknown to history has risen from the jungles. But there is no time for you to explore this curiosity. World splitters from some hostile universe have invaded this land and are drilling for oil. With the help of modern weaponry, you have decided to assist the ancient ancestors of the Olmec, Inca, and Maya. Let's find out if you survive. This show was made possible by the generous contributions of our Patreon community. You can become a patron of the Twilight Histories by visiting the website at twilighthistories.com. Follow the link to our Patreon page. We really appreciate your support. Okay, let's launch right into today's show. Take a deep breath and breathe it out slowly. This is Yucatan Tragedy by Kevin Valbenesi.
The ancient Americas have always been a subject of fascination for travelers, more so those intoxicated by the simple premise of, what if? The two continents witnessed the rise and fall of many peoples, most of them remaining a mystery, even to this day due to a lack of written records and the general sparsity of their populations. And when the world they had left behind long ago in the mists of time finally caught up to them, a rolling tide of doom and desolation would wash over those timeless lands and largely sweep away the civilizations that they were still building for themselves. What might have become of Tenochtitlan had it been left to age and ripen for another 1,000 years? With more time, would the descendants of Cahokia's builders have returned to raise the forgotten mound to heights exceeding its former glory? And what new and splendid capitals might have girded the windswept Andes if the children of the sun had kept their crown? Such questions have answers, lurking in the mists of time for those willing to navigate the shimmering corridors of the cosmos, infinitely complex river networks which flow through time. And while your mind does turn to the mysteries of what if, as you gaze up at the sky overflowing with the glimmer of yet unnamed stars, you are forced to turn your thoughts to a more pressing question. What happened? You have traveled far, plunging back into the shadowy millennia long before a single stone was laid at Tikal. Indeed, you have ventured back to a time when woolly mammoths still roamed the North American continent as lords of the land, and much of the world is still locked in the frigid grasp of the Ice Age. Civilization is a distant dream, a glimmer leading ancient man towards a brilliant horizon. But you aren't here to witness the rise of the first cities or the primal inscriptions which would commence history itself. No, you are here to ensure the sanctity of the historical record. And as you push off from shore and into the antediluvian waters, you already have your sights set on the problem. Far out across the open sea, 5 structures rise above the inky depths, rooted in place and in the calmness of the evening waters, unmoving. Dim lights twinkle and flicker, briefly revealing the outlines of massive towers and cranes. The sinister structures lurk far beyond the shore, their peaks reaching up into the night sky like the spires of a Gothic castle. The pinpricks of red light almost look like the embers escaping from the sulfurous caverns of Tartarus. This distant Dis is several leagues away, granting its wretched residents a measure of safety from those confined to the antediluvian shores. But you are no ordinary traveler in these parts, and you are well equipped for the voyage ahead. You slide your kayak across the nocturnal waters, half praying to the nameless god of the seas and winds to safeguard your journey across the gulf. With your critical gear secured to your life vest by means of wet bags and carabiners, you steel yourself for the mission ahead. You take one last look back at the primordial coast, girded by jagged cliffs and rustling shrubs. Quiet as the night is, you cannot help but feel the gaze of hundreds of eyes peering out from behind the rock outcroppings and from under the denser foliage. Unnerved, you secure yourself in your kayak, and, taking up your paddle, you push off from the haunting shores of the Yucatan and aim for the towering structures ahead. Rough seas have been the end of many a hardy sailor, and brooding darkness of night has concealed countless drownings. And yet, here you are, contending with choppy waves, with little more than the sliver of light reflecting off the waning moon, and glimpses of the comparatively calm sea of stars hanging above you, just visible between breaks in the massive storm clouds. Every stroke of your paddle takes considerable strength, and the spraying surge rocks you back and forth, or sends you airborne for a moment, before you crash back into the jet-black waters. You glance back at the shore you departed not long ago, now a thin, almost imperceptible line. What will one day be called the Yucatan Peninsula is now a distant refuge from the wrath of these prehistoric waters. You curse your bravado, pray that your life vest and your kayak will see you the rest of the way. Your destination is only half a league away now, half obscured in the shroud of night and the endless sea spray. Only the faint glimmering lights atop the structure's towers and peaks offer certainty in this otherwise chaotic voyage. Poor as the visibility is, you're almost counting on it at this point. Your foolhardy wager is that the sudden and harsh storm might at least conceal your passage across the bay from hostile eyes. And, after another half an hour of battling the future Gulf of Mexico, you finally hoist a tether around the railing of a rusted and barnacle-ridden platform at the base of the first structure. You heave yourself out of your kayak and onto the unsteady surface, still forced to contend with the waves. Dragging your vessel onto the platform, you fasten it down, and as you carefully waddle around the platform, trying to gain your footing, you notice shackles dangling from chains secured to the railing. The crew at this facility have a cruel streak, it seems. Taking up one of the shackles in hand, you see the brownish streaks of old blood clinging to the jagged, rusty metal. Man's savagery to man, it seems, has not diminished over the millennia. Gazing down at the inky waters below the platform, you wonder how many were condemned to a watery grave on stormy nights like tonight. Not wasting any more time, you ascend the slippery steps, battered by the raging waves and the nocturnal tempest. Holding onto the railing for dear life, you heave yourself up and around the thick concrete legs suspending this structure above the depths. Your pace is slow, for fear of discovery, or making one bad step and tumbling into the sea. Eventually, you haul yourself up onto the main platform and slide behind a mass of valves and piping. The storm rages harder and harder, and visibility barely extends beyond a few feet as sheets of rain and curtains of sea spray come crashing down around you. It's a mixed bag, ensuring, yes, a measure of cover, but progress is certainly more perilous, especially as you feel the structure rolling and pitching in defiance of the current below. You are determined to give yourself the edge, so you undo one of your wet bags, removing a pair of night vision goggles. You slide them on, turning your world green. Visibility improves a little bit, as you can now penetrate deeper into the darkness, but the droplets clinging to your lenses still render perfect sight impossible. You intend to make do, however, removing the other essential tools for your business here. You slide out a suppressed Radeon pistol, preloaded with the clip display confirming that you have 10 shots at the ready. You also pull out a short combat knife, sliding it into a sheath around your waist. And finally, you remove a small override module, its glowing display confirming that the signal is strong, roughly 60% in sync. This little device will allow you to seize control of the engine that brought these facilities here, but you need to attach it directly for it to work. Otherwise, you and every soul still on here might end up in the heart of a sun, or simply exposed to the vacuum of space. To avoid that mess, you're going to infiltrate the facility, and do things properly, allowing everyone waiting for you back at HQ to deal with the trespassers. Getting to work, you ready your weapon and begin a slow and measured inspection of the facility, making use of the numerous staircases, walkways, and cranes to conceal your movements. Between the maze of the platform and the weather, you may as well be a ghost. You advance with caution, your finger on the trigger, and the blood in your veins running hot as you prepare for a decisive encounter. You clamber up on top of the nearby pilot house, and dragging yourself forward on your belly, you take up your position near the edge, overlooking the entirety of the platform. Peering through your goggles, you find it odd that there's not a soul in sight. Reduced numbers given the storm, certainly, but as you watch empty barrels topple over in the wind or cables swinging madly about, you feel that something is off. Were they so afraid of the weather that they didn't take time to secure their operation? Certainly, the storm came on fast, but dereliction of duty in this manner might scuttle the whole operation. Any damage sustained would effectively be permanent if it could not be repaired immediately, since travel through the time stream would be expensive and ill-advised given the resources available and the risk of discovery. As you ponder that curious carelessness on display, you hear a great thronging up above. You roll over, pointing your weapon skyward. But all you find is the main tower, and the body of the drill nestled within, contending with the high winds. Like a giant, rusty mosquito, this oil rig extends its proboscis down into the depths of the gulf, puncturing Mother Earth's tender flesh and drawing forth the black gold forged by eons of death and pressure. And now, it's as if the planet herself were attempting to dislodge the parasite by way of a tropical storm. Surveying the scene again, you elect not to chance it by inspecting this rig any further. Up ahead, four more remain, with one occupying the central position, linked by taut metal cables and semi-covered bridges. You're certain the engine is fixed in the depths of the central oil rig, but that also means you're likely to expect heavy resistance, regardless of how you approach. A glance down at the raging sea eliminates any notion of crossing by water, so you'll need to take the bridge, leaving yourself visible to a degree, though if a gust of wind or a storm surge hit it just right, you'd be tossed below, and being seen would be the least of your problems. Neither option is particularly appealing, but with the former leading to certain death, you'll at least take the odds presented by the bridge. Clambering down from the roof of the pilot house, you conduct a final sweep of the platform, and, satisfied that no one is hiding there to shoot you in the back, you turn your attention to the next rig. Though visibility is poor, you think you register movement near the base of the drilling tower, perhaps as someone ducks down behind the pilot house over there. It's hard to tell, but it's enough to lend credence to your suspicions. The crew must be holding up near the engine, prepared to evacuate if the storm should grow violent enough to capsize the entire operation. You take a moment to make sure that your gear is secure, and then, holstering your pistol, you approach the semi-covered bridge. A metal frame is wrapped around it, with large gaps allowing the wind to pass through. It's not firmly attached to the platform, but rather it's suspended and secured in place by sturdy cables. There's a decent amount of sway, and it's soaking wet, looking rather antagonistic to anything you might call firm footing. You take a deep breath, and then reaching out with both hands, seize the guide cables on either side of the bridge and begin your crossing. The wind concedes nothing to you. Within a moment of stepping onto the bridge, you are rocked by a vicious gale, your gloved hands struggling to hold on to the soaked guide cables. You cling on for dear life, squatting down and trying to lower your center of gravity. A long beat passes, and as you look ahead, you realize that you are in for a lengthy ordeal. You elect to pull yourself along, moving at a snail's pace, beaten and tossed around by the wind. Your arms burn, the muscle and sinew tearing as you strain to keep yourself from crashing against the semi-cover, or from slipping right between it and plunging into the chaotic waves below. You continue on in this manner until you can finally hurl yourself onto the main platform. Disregarding any attempt, you remain discreet. But, as your senses come back to you, so does your fear of discovery. You pull yourself on your belly, sliding across the platform until you reach a number of crates which have been secured down with a heavy net and carabiners. You draw your pistol and wipe your goggles with your sleeve, finally getting a clear look at the scene that had just moments ago been shrouded by the veil of night and obscured by the monotonous tempest. Time, it seems, has not been on your side. While the orders dictating your mission never once contained the word rescue, you had entertained some notion of saving the inhabitants of this land from the exploitation and careless pollution of their virgin territory. Your mind had raced to scenes of the mysterious tribes who predated the Olmecs and their master masons, and the astronomers who would one day map the very stars themselves under the tutelage of Maya sages. You had hoped to preserve the trajectory of their history from the intercession of those who might at first appear as cruel gods, far worse than the sadistic denizens of Shibalba. But you are too late. Were you to remove your goggles now, the wash of green would doubtless be replaced by the rusty red and hemic purples of old blood, still trickling away and pouring over the sides of the platform and into the sea. Where before, the first rig was conspicuous, the absence of a single soul. Here, the condemned lay arranged in an unforgettable display of twisting, arching, and suspended flesh and sinew. Neither the ceiling of the Sistine nor the bronze gates unto the Inferno can rival the corporeal tempest covering the central oil rig. Bodies lay draped over railing or crumpled on staircases. Some hang from cranes while others slouch against the wall, fixed in place by long metal rods impaling their torsos. Piles of the fallen rise up in every direction, capped by the latest soul to fall and fling their limbs outward during death's final shock. Others are riddled with bullet holes, though they still maintain their vengeful grip through force of rigor mortis. To say this is the aftermath of a battle would be to render the pyramids pebbles. What took place here was a slaughter. You pull your goggles from your head, half hoping you might tear back the curtain of reality and find the place abandoned like the last rig. But no, the nightmare does not fade. Instead, its outlines become sharper. The contours of this macabre scene outlined by the glimmer of the emergency lights off of slick, wet flesh. There are at least 50 bodies here. The two sides in the struggle clearly divided into two distinct camps. One group are the ancient denizens of the Yucatan, the predecessors of Central America's resplendent civilizations, the forefathers of the incomparable Maya, the all-conquering Aztecs, and the mysterious Olmecs. Their dark skin, lean and muscular bodies wrapped in simple loincloths and jet-black hair attest to generations already spent contending with the jungles and harsher weather of Central America. They are, to a man and woman, built like hunters, and it would appear that they went out like warriors. The aforementioned iron rods put up a good fight alongside heavy wrenches, knives, and chains. The ancients knew a good weapon when they saw one, and they put them to terrifying use here. The other group, the ones you came for, are all wearing heavy raincoats, layered on top of overalls and gray shirts. Some are also equipped with scant pieces of body armor, not that it did any of them much good. You also find discarded submachine guns and pistols not far from where they fell. 21st century weapons certainly had devastating effects, but from the sheer chaos of the scene and the close proximity of the dead, it speaks to a sudden uprising where distance was not a luxury enjoyed by the gun-wielding crew. The entire operation had been brought to a halt, with the ancients throwing off the shackles of their newly arrived oppressors. And perhaps the damage has already been done. An entire tribe might have been wiped out in the struggle, word of their capture and disappearance likely spreading on the mainland, little to go on besides the sudden appearance of strangers with terrifying weapons and seaborne towers that they called home. Legends are doubtless being spun at this very moment, rationalizing how and why these mysterious people arrived, and why they sought to bring misery to the peoples of the Yucatan. You fear that those who escaped capture may now cast the invaders as wicked gods, living in perpetual fear of their inevitable return to shore. The best you can do now is to remove the rigs, and perhaps time will allow this painful interlude to fade away. Those who were lost will always be gone, and some memory of the terrifying towers will linger. But you still have a job to do. There may be hope for those who remain behind. The struggle of those who tasted the lash of the invader demonstrates a remarkable resilience, and perhaps the great pyramids and temples of Central America may still rise millennia from now in all their glory. You take up your override module, the screen displaying a 95% sync with the location. The engine is deep inside the rig, without a doubt. You turn and locate the pilot house, and, not wanting to linger, you begin the unnerving trek around the fallen, mindful not to slip on the slick platform. You head up to the entrance and step inside, taking absolutely no precautions. As expected, there's no one alive left to challenge you, just more of the dead crew laying slumped over the control panels. You pass the corpses without a second thought, pressing through a door at the back and down a shadowy staircase leading into the heart of the facility. Reaching the bottom, you pull open the heavy metal door and peer around the corner. You slide your goggles over your eyes, illuminating the complex networks of pipes, walkways, valves, and scaffolding. You close the door behind you and begin to search the area, a measure of prudence returning, encouraging you to stick to the walls and behind cover as much as possible. None of the machinery is currently in use, and the forest of pipes, cables, and valves lays dormant. And curiously enough, there's not a body in sight. As you navigate deeper and deeper through the facility, you finally reach the heart, where the massive drill passes through on its way down into the depths of the sea and the crust of the earth. It's here that you find what you're looking for. Secured, some 10 meters behind the drill, you find the engine which ripped the facility from its solitary decay in the sea of the 21st century to these antediluvian shores. Now dormant, the device is in sound condition, and as you draw nearer, you find the docking station clear and ready to receive your override unit. The device chimes as sync climbs to 99%. You approach the engine's control panel and turn it on. The air instantly teems with energy, and a curious copper taste fills your mouth. As the energy gathers, you feel the world becoming fuzzy, cloudy, less solid. The engine roars to life, and on cue, you slam the override into the docking station. The screen flashes as it seizes control of the engine, dialing in the coordinates for home. And it's in that moment that you sense something. You spin around, drawing your pistol. In the bluish light of the engine, you spy the outlines of expert hunters, those who evaded your gaze, survivors of the slaughter. 4 of them stand there, weapons clutched in their hands, their dark eyes fixed with murderous intent on you. These 4 men of the tribe, older, scarred, and freshly wounded from their ordeal, all look on at yet one more trespasser in these timeless lands. You can see the rage etched in their faces, their soul desiring recompense for the horror unleashed upon their people. And now, as the engine's power begins to flow throughout the rig and over all of you, it becomes clear that there will be a reckoning. You are not coming home alone.
That was Yucatan Tragedy by Kevin Valbenesi. We sent out a poll to our fans, asking them to rate our shows. We wanted to know what Twilight History shows you enjoy, and what you don't. Tons of fans voted, enough for us to get a really good sense of which shows you connect with. So what I'm going to do here is give you our top 10 list. These are the top 10 best Twilight History shows, according to our fans. Starting at number 10 is Rings in the Mist by Kevin Valbenesi. This is a really cool multi-part show that takes place in a misty Celtic setting with exotic tech, and it has lots of action. Next, at number 9, is The Winged Victory. I always had a soft spot for this show because I really poured myself into it. But while the first and third parts were, I think, pretty good, the middle part was not. So while I'm pleased it made it to the list, I think with time it will eventually be bumped down as we put out stronger shows. At number 8, we have another story by Kevin Valbenesi. This one is May His Ka Endure Forever. This takes place in an exotic Egypt with deep caverns under the desert, and the show has a wonderful surprise ending. I've heard lots of people say they love this one. Next up, at number 7, is Blue Dragons, a behemoth of a show, and one of our strangest, involving intergalactic spacefaring dinosaurs, planet terraforming, and consciousness melding with computers. Number 6 is The Blood Ape. This is a story that takes place in our deep evolutionary past in Africa, in a world where civilization started early. You visit a proto-city that's full of different species of apes all living together, sometimes not so peacefully. Number 5 is The Black Scourge. This is a huge multi-part show that took me over a year to build out. The premise is that something destroyed medieval Europe, and the Vikings ferried the survivors to the New World, where they built cities along the coast. At number 4, we have The Romano-Saxon War by Josh Hutchins, a huge story that takes place during the exodus of the Romans from Britain. This is our longest-running show, and Josh turned it into a book, which you can buy at the Twilight History's website, incidentally. Josh has some incredible fans who absolutely rave whenever they see a new show out by him, and we have to do more. Number 3 is The Drowned City by Kevin Valbenesi. This one takes place in a world very reminiscent of the Sumerians, but it's much faster and more technologically advanced. It's also empty. The city is mostly submerged, with only the tallest buildings rising above the water. Kevin said, of all the shows he's produced so far, he put the most work into The Drowned City. Number 2 is Aztec Steel. You travel to a world where the Aztecs gain European weaponry and are able to push back the invaders. You are captured and led to a temple where you are to be sacrificed. And now for number 1. Can you guess it? Do you have it figured out? Well, if you nailed this one, give yourself a pat on the back because it's Mask of the Plague Doctor. You travel back to the medieval world during the Black Death and are mentored by a barber who becomes the city's plague doctor. This story is one of our keystones, a must-listen, and as you probably know, our cover art is designed after this story. And that's our top 10 list. This is all extremely interesting to me. First of all, it tells me I personally haven't produced a quality show in a very long time. What's most disturbing is that my best work is over 10 years old. It also tells me that Kevin Valbenesi is creating amazing shows that you love, and Josh Hutchins' Romano-Saxon War is one of our best. The survey also tells me that the original format that was built out right at the start with those earliest shows like Aztec Steel and Mask of the Plague Doctor, that worked. And because our latest shows, which have been mostly short 10-minute stories, are not making your list, and I mean not even one of them made the top 20, maybe it's time to put those away and focus instead on the types of shows that you really connect with. Tristan Verboven, for instance, has been producing absolutely mind-blowing stories this past year, and the quality is incredible. He's setting new standards, sourcing unique sound effects, and even bringing in voice actors. But his stories are also in that short 10-minute format, so they're simply not able to compete with the longer shows that you want. His show called The Blight, for instance, absolutely blew me away. If he had expanded that to a 45-minute or 1-hour show, I'm almost certain it would have made our top 10 list. So here's what we're going to do. Starting in September, you're going to get fewer shows from us, but the shows that you do get are going to be longer. Each month, you'll get either a big 1-hour show, or if you're really lucky, one of us will produce a multi-part show for you. I'm writing one of those huge shows right now to kick us off for September. The working title is Ojibwe Miners, though it may change. So far, it looks like a 5-part show plus a bonus track for our patrons. And that's also very important. Going forward, we're going to be adding bonus tracks to our shows that will continue the stories in the same world that you're exploring. The bonus tracks will allow us to build more regular content for our patrons. After all, Patreon is how we make these shows possible. So we want to make sure that our patrons are fed with regular quality content. The feed will be silent for the rest of August as we build our shows for the fall. So don't expect anything here next month. But once September hits, then we're going full bore with the Ojibwe Miners. And after that, big stories for you in the format that you've come to know and love. I'll leave you with that today. Thank you again for listening to the Twilight Histories and for joining us on this journey. If you want to help us out, please become a patron of the show by visiting us at twilighthistories.com and follow the link to our Patreon page. Our back catalog there should hopefully tide you over for the rest of the summer until we launch our next show. And I'll also give you updates on the Ojibwe Miners and perhaps even a sneak peek. I'm Jordan Harbour. Thanks for listening to the Twilight Histories. Until next time, take care.